Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
You're only given a little spark of madness. You mustn't lose it. Welcome, Deep Divers, to an exploration into a life that burned with, well, just an unparalleled spark of madness and genius. Robin Williams.
That's a perfect quote to start with. Really captures him.
It really does. And look, this isn't just going to be a chronological review of his incredible career. We want this to be more of an immersive dive into the intricate layers of a truly unique individual.
Exactly. There's so much there.
We've basically taken a stack of sources, primarily a really comprehensive Wikipedia entry, which is great because it offers not just the factual milestones and career highlights, but also some deeply personal anecdotes and, crucially, insights into his private struggles.
Mm-hmm. Which are essential to understanding him, really.
Totally. So yeah. Our mission today, it's pretty clear. We want to unearth the most important nuggets of knowledge about Williams. Give you a shortcut, maybe, to understanding the man behind those, you know, legendary performances.
From the sheer improvisational brilliance to the very private battles he fought.
Right. We're here to connect the dots, look for those aha moments that kind of illuminate his story. We want you to walk away not just informed, but genuinely, you know, touched by his complexity.
And I think this deep dive is particularly compelling because, I mean, Robin Williams's impact across both comedy and drama, mm-hmm. it's just immense. It's universally acknowledged.
You can't overstate it.
You really yeah. can't. Yet those surprising revelations about his personal life that came out, you know, posthumously, they added this entirely new, often heartbreaking dimension to his whole narrative.
Yeah.
He had this incredible, almost universal appeal that, honestly, very few artists ever achieve.
Mm.
So today, yeah, we'll look beyond the surface. We'll examine that intricate interplay between his, like, vibrant public persona and his often unseen private struggles.
Especially the health challenges later on.
Especially those profound health challenges, yes. Our goal is basically to synthesize all these diverse facets into, hopefully, a cohesive understanding, helping you grasp not just what happened in his life, but really why it matters to his enduring legacy, and maybe even to our own understanding of, you know, human complexity.
Okay, let's dive in then. How did this whirlwind of a man, Robin Williams, truly begin? Where did that boundless energy first take root?
It's a fascinating question, isn't it? Because the public, Robin Williams was just so explosive, yet his beginnings were, well, surprisingly quiet.
Really? Quiet?
Yeah. Robin McLaurin Williams, born July 21st, 1951, in Chicago, Illinois. And he came from a pretty well-established family. His father, Robert Fitzgerald Williams, was a senior executive at Ford in the Lincoln Mercury division.
Okay, so quite successful.
Very. And his mother, Lori McLaurin, she was a former model. And she had this interesting lineage, too. Her great-grandfather was actually a Mississippi senator and governor, Anselm J. McLaurin.
Wow, okay. Deep roots there.
Definitely. And Robin wasn't an only child. He had two older half-brothers, Robert, who went by Todd, and McLaurin.
Right.
He was raised Episcopalian, which is interesting because his mother actually practiced Christian Science.
Mm.
So, yeah, contrast right from the start.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this sweet detail he shared. I think it was in a 2001 Inside the Actor's Studio interview. He credited his mother as a really important early influence on his humor. He said he was often trying to make her laugh just to gain attention in their home.
That's a poignant image, isn't it? This future global superstar, just a kid performing for his toughest audience, his mom.
Absolutely. It paints such a picture.
And you mentioned quiet beginnings. That's almost hard to reconcile with Barb and we all think we know. Can you tell us more about that shy child?
Yeah, it's one of the great paradoxes of his life, really. Initially, Williams was described as, yes, a quiet, shy child. He was even bullied for his weight, apparently, often playing alone at home.
Wow, it's hard to imagine.
Isn't it? Just picture that quiet boy who would one day command stages and screens globally. His family moved around a bit, too, first from Lake Forest, Illinois, then to Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, when he was about 12.
Okay.
And there, they lived in this rather grand 40-room farmhouse on 20 acres. Pretty nice setup.
40 rooms? Yeah, that's more than nice.
Right. And he attended this private all-boys school, Detroit Country Day School, and maybe surprisingly, he excelled academically there. He was class president, even on the wrestling team.
Class president and wrestling. So not just the class clown type even then. There was discipline.
Exactly. It shows this discipline-driven side that I think often gets overlooked because of the, you know, the manic energy we associate with him.
Okay, so when did the shift happen? When did the performer emerge?
Well, the really significant shift seems to have come when his family moved again, this time to Tiburon, California, when he was 16. He went to Redwood High School in nearby Larkspur. And it was there that he got involved with the high school drama department. And that seems to be where his shyness truly began to melt away. Performance was the key.
Ah, the classic drama kid transformation.
Kind of, yeah. Although his classmates, you know, with that classic high school blend of maybe affection and teasing, they voted him most likely not to succeed.
No, seriously.
Seriously. But also, perhaps more fittingly, funniest.
Oh, okay. Well, they got one right. That's hilarious. Most likely not to succeed.
I know. It's this incredible paradox, isn't it? A shy, bullied child transformed by getting on stage. It really reveals a powerful truth, I think. Often the most explosive talents are forged in these quiet struggles, maybe driven by a deep human need to connect and just express yourself.
Yeah, that makes sense. Those quiet formative beginnings laying the groundwork.
Precisely.
And that transformation, I guess it only accelerated once he hit Juilliard, right? Christopher Reeves famously said Williams arrived like an untied balloon. Tell us about his time there. Was it just instantly obvious he was some kind of genius?
Well, it was definitely a complex period, but ultimately, yeah, pivotal. So 1973, Williams gets a full scholarship to the prestigious Juilliard School in New York City.
Full scholarship. Impressive.
Very. He was part of what they call Group 6, attended from 73 to 76. And get this, out of 20 students accepted into his freshman class, he and Christopher Reeve were the only two specifically accepted by the legendary John Houseman for the school's advanced program that year.
Wow. Houseman himself. Okay.
Yeah. Imagine the intensity, sharing a classroom with future stars like William Hurt and Mandy Patinkin.
Incredible talent pool.
Totally. And Reeve's first impression, it's just iconic, isn't it? He described Williams as like an untied balloon that had been inflated and immediately released. I watched in awe as he virtually caromed off the walls.
Caroming off the walls, I love it.
Of the classrooms and hallways. To say that he was on would be a major understatement. So this raw, uncamed energy wasn't just, you know, fooling around. It seems it was an integral part of his unique genius.
You could see it even then.
Even in the technical classes.
Mm.
Like in their dialects class, taught by Edith Skinner, who was one of the world's leading voice and speech teachers. By the way, Skinner was apparently just bewildered by Williams' instant ability to perform tons of different accents, flawlessly.
Just like that. Wow.
Just like that. But, you know, not everyone immediately saw the depths in his antics. His main acting teacher, Michael Kahn, initially criticized his style. He kind of dismissed it as simple stand-up comedy.
Ouch. That must have stung.
Probably. But that criticism, it actually became a significant turning point. Williams responded not by arguing, but by silencing his critics with this remarkably well-received dramatic performance. He played an old man in Tennessee Williams's Night of the Iguana.
Ah, showing the range.
Exactly. Rhett remembered being completely astonished by his work in that. And that moment seems to have really solidified his dramatic chops in the eyes of his peers and mentors there.
And that friendship with Reeve, it lasted, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. They remained exceptionally close friends throughout their lives. A bond so strong that Williams's son, Zach, later described them as brothers from another mother. Just a really deep connection forged in that intense environment.
So he clearly proved he had the dramatic range, even back then at Juilliard. But he ended up leaving before graduating, right? Was that because of the earlier criticism or was it something else entirely?
It was actually quite the opposite of failure, really. It was more a testament to his unique path. Williams left Juilliard during his junior year in 1976.
Okay.
Not because he wasn't good enough, but because, according to John Houseman himself, Houseman suggested the school basically had nothing more to teach him.
Houseman said that. Wow.
Yeah. And another teacher, Gerald Friedman, he apparently called Williams a genius and felt that Juilliard's, you know, more conservative and classical style of training just didn't suit his improvisational kind of boundless spirit.
So they recognize he was maybe too unique for their system.
It seems like it. For those who really understood him, his departure was simply a recognition that his talent had already outgrown that traditional academic setting. You know, these formative years, the mix of academic success, the dramatic breakthroughs, the recognition from seasoned pros, those deep friendships, they all profoundly shaped the artist he would become.
Yeah, it showed his path was destined to be anything but conventional.
Absolutely. Anything but.
That's an incredible story of transformation. But okay, what happens next? That raw energy hits the real world, the stage, specifically the famous San Francisco comedy clubs. From those formative years, Williams basically explodes onto the San Francisco comedy scene in the 70s, and that's where things got really interesting, didn't they?
Oh, indeed. After Gilliard, Williams didn't waste any time at all. He just plunged right into performing stand-up comedy in the San Francisco Bay Area, starting around 1976.
Right into the fire.
Totally. His very first performance was at the Holy City Zoo, which is a well-known San Francisco comedy club, and he literally worked his way up from tending bar there.
Paying his dues. You gotta love it.
You do. And you have to understand the context of San Francisco at that time. I mean, the 60s had made it this hub for rock music, the hippie movement, the sexual revolution.
Right, a very counterculture vibe.
Exactly. And by the late 1970s, it was undergoing what people called a comedy renaissance. It was just fertile ground for new talent. And Williams quickly became a leading figure in that whole scene.
He must have thrived in that environment.
He did, but he was also very candid about it later. Reflecting on that era, Williams spoke about discovering drugs and happiness during this period. But also, tragically, he saw, quote, "the best brains of my time turned to mud." A really stark reminder of the darker side of all that freedom.
That honesty, even about his struggles, that really became a hallmark of his later career, didn't it? That willingness to talk about the tough stuff.
Absolutely. He was incredibly brave, especially back then. But before he hit the big time, he was really honing that craft night after night.
Where else did he perform?
Well, he then moved down to Los Angeles and kept performing at legendary clubs like the Comedy Store and the Roxy.
Mm.
He specifically did that to sharpen those incredible improvisational skills.
Right. L.A. being the next big step.
Yeah. He even took his act overseas, performed at a place called the Fighting Cocks in England.
Yeah.
Just spreading his unique brand of chaos, you know.
The Fighting Cocks.
Okay. And I heard there's a great story about David Letterman seeing him for the first time.
Oh, it's fantastic. David Letterman, who was already, you know, an established comedian at the Comedy Store at the time, he recalled Williams' arrival as being like a hurricane.
A hurricane.
Yeah. Making Letterman think, and this is a direct quote, "Holy crap, there goes my chance in show business."
Wow. That says everything, doesn't it? Coming from Letterman.
It really puts into perspective the sheer force of nature. Williams was on stage right from the very start. A performer who could just instantly change the game for everyone else around him.
Amazing.
Yeah.
What about his first film roles around this time? His first credited film role was actually a minor part in this low-budget comedy called Can I Do It Till I Need Glasses,
mm-hmm.
back in 1977. Pretty obscure.
Okay.
His first starring film role, though, was as Popeye in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And he really showcased his acting skills there, even if the film itself was kind of a commercial disappointment. But interestingly, that wasn't really blamed on his performance. People recognized his talent in it.
Right, Popeye. I remember that. He really embodied that character physically.
He did. He threw himself into it.
That Letterman quote, though, it really paints a picture. It wasn't just that Williams was funny. It sounds like it was incredibly innovative, unique, something people hadn't really seen before in that pure form.
Exactly. Raw, unpredictable energy.
But this raises a really important question, I think. How did he manage to translate that kind of raw improvisational energy from the, you know, intimacy of a club stage to the much broader audience of television and film? That's a huge leap.
It is a huge leap. And his success on Mork and Mindy wasn't just about becoming famous. It was really a masterclass in translating that lightning-fast improvisational genius from stage to screen. He proved that truly innovative comedy could actually work on TV.
So Mork and Mindy was the key. How did that come about?
Well, his television breakthrough, of course, was that Mork and Mindy phenomenon. After his appearance on the Laugh-In revival, which didn't really take off, and a stint on the Richard Pryor show, Williams was cast as the alien Mork in a 1978 episode of Happy Days.
On Happy Days, that's right. I forgot Mork started there.
Yep. The episode was called My Favorite Orkin. And the audition story itself is legendary. Apparently, when producer Gary Marshall asked him to take a seat, Williams, without missing a beat, just sat on his head.
On his head! Classic!
Totally. Immediately impressing Marshall with his quirky humor and, you know, totally out-of-the-box thinking.
So Marshall saw the potential right away.
Instantly. As Mork, Williams improvised a lot of his dialogue and physical comedy, speaking in that really distinctive high nasal voice. Na-na-na-nu.
Na-nu-na-nu. Shazbot.
Exactly. He truly made the most of the script, just adding layers and layers of unexpected humor. The cast, the crew, even the network executives were reportedly so impressed that they signed him to a contract just 4 days later.
4 days. Wow, they move fast.
They knew they had something special, and they didn't want anyone else grabbing him. This huge popularity led directly to the spin-off sitcom, Mork and Mindy, co-starring the wonderful Pam Dauber, which ran from 1978 to 1982.
And they really let him loose on that show, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. The show was specifically written to accommodate his extreme improvisations, both in dialogue and behavior. They basically gave him free rein to create on the spot, which is pretty rare for a network sitcom.
Unheard of, almost. And the ratings were huge.
Astronomical. At its peak, Mork and Mindy commanded a weekly audience of 60 million viewers. 60 million. It instantly turned Williams into a global superstar.
60 million people watching him improvise every week. Incredible.
He was particularly popular with young people. Critic James Poniewozik noted he was seen as a man and a child, buoyant, rubber-faced, an endless gusher of ideas. That really captures it.
Yeah, that energy was infectious.
And Mork became this merchandising sensation, remember? Posters, coloring books, lunchboxes. He was everywhere.
Oh, yeah, the rainbow suspenders?
The suspenders.
Oh.
Williams' face graced the cover of Time magazine on March 12, 1979. That photo later found a permanent place in the National Portrait Gallery after his death. He was also on the cover of Rolling Stone in August 79. Just a true indicator of his meteoric rise.
It really sounds like Mork and Mindy wasn't just a TV show. It was like a weekly showcase for his particular brand of genius. How did this newfound massive celebrity translate back to his stand-up career? Did he even still do stand-up?
Oh, absolutely. This television success actually propelled his stand-up career to completely new heights. He smartly leveraged his Mork and Mindy fame to reach an even wider audience with his comedy.
So he didn't abandon the stage?
Not at all. He proved that his stage act was just as compelling, maybe even more so in some ways, than his TV persona. He released 3 really acclaimed HBO specials during this period, Off the Wall in 78, An Evening with Robin Williams in 83, and the iconic A Night at the Met in 1986.
A Night at the Met is legendary.
Absolutely legendary. Each one showcased his evolving style and that just boundless energy. He even won a Grammy Award for Best Comedy Album for the recording of his 1979 live show, Reality. What a concept.
So Grammys, TV stardom, he was firing on all cylinders.
Totally. Mm. His ability to harness that raw, improvisational energy across different mediums, stage, TV, and make it so universally appealing, that truly cemented his status as his incredibly innovative and unique talent. It really laid the foundation for everything that followed in film.
Okay, so let's talk about that transition to film. It can be notoriously tough, right? Especially for someone who became so huge, so almost defined by a TV character like Mork. How did Robin Williams navigate that? Was it like a conscious decision to pivot to more dramatic roles? Or did Hollywood just suddenly wake up and realize his extraordinary range?
I think it's probably a blend of both, really. His film career properly took off after Mork and Mindy wound down, and it does seem like he deliberately sought out diverse roles right from the start.
He didn't want to be typecast as Mork forever.
Exactly. He starred as the lead character in The World According to Garp back in 1982. He himself felt the role may have lacked a certain madness on screen, but it had a great core.
And critics noticed the difference, right?
They did. Roger Ebert observed that Williams played Garp as a relatively plausible, sometimes ordinary person, even amidst all the story's inherent anarchy. It really showcased his ability to ground characters, even in fantastical settings. That was an early signal of his serious dramatic potential.
So Garp is a key step.
Definitely. Now, he did take on some smaller roles in films like The Survivors in 83 and Club Paradise in 86. Later on, he felt those didn't quite advance his film career as much as he'd hoped, which suggests he was already thinking pretty strategically about his trajectory.
Interesting. He was already managing his path.
Seems like it.
Yeah.
But his star power was still undeniable. I mean, he co-hosted the 58th Academy Awards in 1986.
Yeah.
That shows his command of a live audience on the biggest stage.
Yeah, hosting the Oscars is no small feat.
And he appeared in that sketch comedy special, Carol, Carl, Whoopi, and Robin in 87, alongside other comedy legends. Plus, he was just a regular, much-loved guest on talk shows. You mentioned Letterman earlier. He appeared an astonishing 50 times on Late Night with David Letterman.
50 times. That's practically a residency. His appearances were always electric.
Always. His improvisational wit was just perfect for that format. Always a highlight.
Okay, but what was the role? What was the film that truly broke him into that next league, that finally got the critics and maybe the industry to fully see his dramatic potential beyond just the manic energy?
I think most people would point to director Barry Levinson's Good Morning Vietnam in 1987. That was his first major cinematic breakthrough in that sense.
Ah, yes. GVN. Huge.
Huge. And it earned him his first Academy Award nomination for Best Actor. He played Adrian Cronauer, the radio shock jock, during the Vietnam War. And famously, he improvised most of his lines within the script.
All those voices and impressions during the radio segment.
Exactly. Doing a flurry of voice impressions. Walter Cronkite, Elvis Presley, Gomer Pyle, even Richard Nixon. Producer Mark Johnson said they basically just let the cameras roll. And Williams managed to create something new for every single take. It was incredible.
That movie perfectly showcased his unique blend, didn't it? The comedy and the drama side by side.
Perfectly. It proved he could blend that humor with real pathos in a way few could. And he followed that up pretty quickly with Dead Poets Society in 1989.
Oh, Captain. My Captain.
Exactly. Playing John Keating, that inspiring private school English teacher, urging his students to seize the day. That film wasn't just a box office success. It became a genuine cultural touchstone.
It really did. So influential.
It influenced countless teachers and students with its message about individuality and the power of poetry. Then he got another Oscar nomination for The Fisher King in 1991.
Playing Perry, the homeless man searching for the Holy Grail. A very different role again.
Totally different. Troubled, poignant. And then there was Awakenings in 1990, where he played Dr. Malcolm Sayer, the neurologist character modeled after Oliver Sacks.
Right, based on Sacks' book.
Yeah, and Sacks himself later called Williams' mind a form of genius.
Yeah.
For his ability to embody the quiet empathy of that character. High praise from the man himself.
That's amazing. And then, of course, the Oscar win.
Finally, yes. In 1997, he won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for his role as Sean McGuire, the therapist in Good Will Hunting.
Such a powerful performance. The park bench scene.
Unforgettable. That performance was so raw and honest, it apparently deeply affected even real therapists. Just incredible vulnerability on screen.
What's truly remarkable, looking back, is his ability to just seamlessly move between that comedic brilliance and this profound dramatic depth. He didn't just, like, play characters. He genuinely became them somehow.
That's a great way to put it.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this versatility, this huge emotional range, it's just a testament to his unique artistry, isn't it?
Precisely. And Williams infused even his animated roles with a kind of humanity that resonated so deeply. He offered an emotional range that, honestly, very few actors ever achieve.
Even in comedy, there was often that touch of sadness.
Exactly. Many of his roles, even the big comedic hits like Mrs. Doubtfire or Patch Adams, were, as you say, tinged with pathos. They showed a vulnerability beneath the humor that really drew audiences in. One writer was just struck by the breadth and the radical diversity of his filmography.
Terry Gilliam worked with him a couple of times, right? Fisher King and Baron Munchausen.
Yes. And Gilliam said back in 92 that Williams had the ability to go from manic to mad to tender and vulnerable. He called Williams the most unique mind on the planet. There's nobody like him out there.
High praise from Gilliam. And was he influenced by other actors? Did he talk about learning from his peers?
Oh, definitely. He was apparently a lifelong student of acting. He learned from others he admired, like Robert De Niro, for example, he said, taught him the power of silence and the economy of dialogue.
Interesting, because Williams was known for the opposite.
Right, but maybe he saw the value in contrast. And Dustin Hoffman, his co-star in Hook, apparently taught him about taking on totally different character types and really transforming characters through extreme preparation and deep character work.
Learning from the best.
Absolutely. Even Woody Allen, who directed him and Billy Crystal in Deconstructing Harry, really valued Williams' specific comedic timing and his stage work with Crystal. That was a unique partnership in itself.
Okay, and then we have to talk about the genie. You mentioned animated roles.
Mm-hmm.
His voice work as the genie in Disney's Aladdin back in 92, that truly set a whole new standard, didn't it?
Oh, completely. It was groundbreaking.
But wasn't there some initial reluctance on his part to take on such a high-profile animated role? And how did his signature improvisational style even translate to voice acting? It seems like a different beast.
You're right, it is different, but he made it work spectacularly. His voice role as the genie in Aladdin was so impactful, it literally changed the animation industry.
Really? How so?
Well, first, the role was actually written specifically for him. They wanted that Robin Williams energy. But initially, yeah, he was incredibly reluctant. He actually refused.
Why? It seems like a perfect fit.
Because he didn't want Disney to profit excessively by selling merchandise based on the movie. He preferred the focus to remain on the film itself as art.
Wow, that's a principled stance.
It was a bold stance for a star at that time, absolutely.
Yeah.
But it really spoke to his integrity as an artist. He eventually accepted, but with specific, very stringent conditions. He famously stated, "I just don't want to sell anything, as in Burger King, as in toys, as in stuff."
He really laid down the law.
He did. And his improvisation for the role, just legendary. He recorded approximately 30 hours of tape.
30 hours for one character?
30 hours.
Mm-hmm.
For a character that ultimately had less than 20 minutes of screen time, he just spontaneously impersonated dozens and dozens of celebrities. Ed Sullivan, Jack Nicholson, De Niro, Groucho Marx, Rodney Dangerfield, William F. Buckley Jr., Peter Lorre, Schwarzenegger, Arsenio Hall, just on and
it's
on.
It's riffed for hours.
Basically, yeah. Bringing the character to life with his unpredictable, kinetic, hilarious energy. It became one of his most recognized and just best-loved roles ever.
Oh, definitely. Everyone knows the genie.
And the film was the highest grossing of 1992. Williams won a special Golden Globe for vocal work in a motion picture that was an unprecedented award at the time.
A special Golden Globe just for his voice work.
Just for him. And his performance really paved the way for other animated films to start incorporating big-name star actors and to embrace improvisational voice work much more. He opened that door.
So he essentially broke new ground and changed how animated films were cast and even produced. But you mentioned there was a dispute with Disney later. What happened there? He said he didn't want merch.
Yeah, despite the huge success, there was a significant dispute with Disney over advertising. Apparently, the studio went back on their agreement not to heavily merchandise the genie character and not to use his voice specifically to sell products and ads.
So they broke the deal.
That's what Williams felt. And this led him to refuse to participate in the direct-to-video sequel, The Return of Jafar, which came out in 1994. Dan Castellaneta, Homer Simpson himself, voiced the genie in that one.
Right, I remember it wasn't him in the sequel.
But after a public apology from the new Disney chairman at the time, Joe Roth, and presumably some new terms were agreed upon, Williams did return for the third film, Aladdin and the King of Thieves, in 1996.
Okay, so they patched things up eventually.
Seems so. It showed his willingness to reconcile, probably for the sake of the character and the fans, once his artistic and professional boundaries were respected again. And, you know, for his immense contributions to the company and entertainment overall, he was rightfully named a Disney legend in 2009.
As he should be. His career, especially with roles like the genie, just showcased an incredible emotional range and an ability to embody characters across any genre, any medium.
Absolutely. A true phenomenon.
It's really remarkable, then, to see how Williams continued to evolve as an actor, even as he began facing increasing personal challenges later in his career. Let's shift our focus now to those later years and how he continued to push boundaries, often into much darker territory, actually, even while battling his own demons.
Indeed. Moving into the 2000s, Williams really demonstrated a new dimension to his versatility. He started taking on significantly darker, more unsettling roles than he had really done in previous decades. It was quite a stark contrast to the lovable, often funny characters he was mostly known for.
Like what kind of roles?
Well, in Christopher Nolan's Insomnia in 2002, he portrayed this chilling murderer, Walter Finch, opposite Al Pacino. His performance was just utterly devoid of his typical humor, revealing this genuinely menacing side. It was quite shocking, actually.
Yeah, I remember that. He was terrifying in that.
He really was. And that same year, in the psychological thriller One-Hour Photo, he played Cy Parrish, this emotionally disturbed photo development technician who becomes obsessed with a family whose pictures he's developed for years. Again, a truly unsettling turn that showcased his capacity for quiet menace.
See the photo guy. Creepy, but brilliant.
Totally creepy, totally brilliant. And he further explored this darker side in The Final Cut in 2004, where he played Alan Hockman, a professional specializing in editing people's memories into these, like, uncritical memorials for funerals. another complex, morally ambiguous role.
So he was really leaning into these challenging, darker characters. Was he trying to consciously move away from comedy?
It seems like he was definitely seeking out roles that challenged audience expectations and maybe his own comedic typecasting. It showed real artistic courage, I think.
Yeah, definitely. But he didn't abandon comedy entirely during this period, did he? How did he balance these darker turns with the lighter stuff people still expected from him?
No. His range remained incredibly broad. These dramatic shifts didn't mean he abandoned his comedic roots at all. He continued to appear in other films like Man of the Year, which was a political satire in 2006, or The Night Listener, another thriller in 2006, and World's Greatest Dad in 2009.
Oh, World's Greatest Dad is dark comedy. Very dark.
Extremely dark humor, yeah. Playing a father who crafts this posthumous image for his deceased son. Again, exploring those themes of dark humor and profound sadness. So complex even in the comedy.
And voice work continued too.
Oh yeah, his voice work continued to be a significant part of his career. He was in Robots in 2005, the Happy Feet franchise from 2006 to 2011.
Loved him in Happy Feet, both characters.
Right, Ramon and Lovelace. And he was Dr. No in Spielberg's AI Artificial Intelligence back in 2001. He even lent his voice to a Disney World attraction, The Timekeeper, playing a time-traveling robot. So, still very connected to family entertainment as well.
It seems like his career also saw him returning to television and even the stage during this later period. He was always adapting.
Totally adaptable. He hosted an Audible talk show, believe it or not, back in April 2000. He made memorable guest appearances on shows like Whose Line Is It Anyway? Which was perfect for him.
Oh, he must have destroyed on Whose Line.
Completely. Also Law & Order, Special Victims Unit, a dramatic turn there. Saturday Night Live with Robert De Niro, Louis Wilfred. He popped up in interesting places.
And Broadway.
Yes. In 2011, he made his Broadway acting debut in Rajiv Joseph's play, Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo. And he earned a nomination for a Drama League Award for Outstanding Distinguished Performer. It really confirmed his legitimacy as a serious stage actor, too.
So, stage, screen, big and small, voice work. He really did it all. What about that CBS series he did near the end?
Right, The Crazy Ones. That launched in May 2013, starring Williams and Sarah Michelle Gellar. It had potential, but unfortunately, it was canceled after just one season.
That's a shame.
It was. And his final film released during his lifetime was The Angriest Man in Brooklyn in 2014. He played this angry, bitter man trying to change his life after getting a terminal diagnosis, a role that, you know, in retrospect, takes on a particularly haunting quality.
Yeah. Given what came next, were there films released after he passed away?
Yes. Four more films starring him were released posthumously. Night at the Museum, Secret of the Tomb, A Merry Friggin' Christmas, Boulevard, and Absolutely Anything, where he voiced Dennis the Dog.
Wow. That's a remarkable level of continued output across so many different platforms, right up until the end. It seems like he was just always creatively engaged, always working.
He really was, nonstop.
And this comprehensive view of his life, you know, not just the career, but the personal side, his hobbies, his philanthropy, his struggles, it reveals such a man of immense passions and deep compassion, didn't it? Even while constantly battling these internal demons, he gave so much to the world, it really makes you wonder how one person could contain such multitudes.
It truly does. He was incredibly complex.
What were some of those passions outside of acting? What did he love to do?
Well, his interests beyond the screen were just as varied and passionate as his performances, it seems. Oh. He was an avid runner, apparently, part of the West Side YMCA Runners Club when he lived in New York City. He even ran a 10K in Central Park back in 1975 in a really respectable 34 minutes and 21 seconds.
Wow, 34.21. That's quick. It shows a dedication to physical fitness.
Definitely. He was also a profound reader. Isaac Asimov's Foundation trilogy was apparently a particular favorite of his. And The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was a beloved childhood book that he later shared with his own children.
That's lovely. What about games? I heard he was a gamer.
Oh, a fervent gaming enthusiast.
Yeah.
Deeply invested in both, like old-school pen-and-paper role-playing games and video games.
Okay, cool.
His daughter, Zelda, was famously named after the title character from The Legend of Zelda. That's a pretty big testament to it being a family favorite and his enduring love for the medium.
Naming your daughter Zelda, that's commitment.
Right. He even performed at consumer entertainment trade shows sometimes, like E3, blending his public persona with his private passion for gaming.
That's awesome. Any other surprising hobbies?
Anime. His love for anime was also quite pronounced. His daughter described him as a figurine hoarder. He was a big fan of films like Appleseed and Ghost in the Shell 2. Innocence.
Okay, a man of diverse tastes. And cycling. I heard cycling was huge for him.
Huge. Cycling became another really devoted passion and sort of partly, maybe significantly, as a healthy substitute for drugs during his recovery periods.
Ah, using it as a positive outlet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He amassed this large bicycle collection over the years and closely followed professional road cycling events like the Tour de France. Mm. He was really into it. And in a beautiful gesture after he passed away, his children donated 87 of his bikes to various charities in 2016.
87 bikes. Wow. That's incredible, extending his generosity even posthumously.
It really is. It shows it wasn't just about collecting. It was part of his recovery and ultimately part of his giving back, too.
Speaking of giving back, his philanthropic efforts are just legendary, aren't they? Comic Relief USA is probably the most famous example.
Absolutely legendary. His philanthropic endeavors were equally remarkable, seemingly driven by this deep sense of social responsibility. In 1986, he co-founded Comic Relief USA with Whoopi Goldberg and Billy Crystal.
Icons, all three.
Truly.
Yeah.
And that initiative went on to raise an incredible $80 million for the homeless by 2014. $80 million.
That's staggering. What motivated him there?
Bob Zmuda, who created Comic Relief, noted that Williams, feeling genuinely blessed from coming from a wealthy home, simply wanted to help those less fortunate. He viewed it almost as his duty.
A sense of responsibility.
Yeah. And he supported numerous other causes: literacy, women's rights, veterans' welfare. He was a regular on the USO circuit, performing for U.S. Armed Forces overseas.
Oh, and entertain the troops.
He traveled to 13 countries and entertained approximately 90,000 troops, just bringing much-needed laughter and morale to those serving so far from home. The USO specifically thanked him for all he did for the men and women of our armed forces. It was a real dedication.
That's amazing commitment. Any other major causes?
With his second wife, Marcia Garces, he founded the Windfall Foundation to support many different charities. He even donated all the proceeds from a 2010 performance he did in Christchurch, New Zealand, to help rebuild the city after that devastating earthquake there, just channeling his energy into tangible support.
Wow, just helping out wherever he could.
Seems like it. He was also a staunch supporter of St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, quietly using his fame to benefit some of the most vulnerable kids. Just incredible generosity all around.
That level of generosity, combined with what we now know about his private battles, it just makes his story even more complex and, frankly, more moving. You mentioned his use of cycling as a substitute for drugs earlier. How did his struggles with substance abuse actually unfold over his career? He was quite open about it later on.
He was remarkably open, especially for his time. Alongside this immense generosity and his huge public persona, Williams battled significant substance abuse issues. During the late 1970s and early 1980s, he had an addiction to cocaine.
Right, during that intense early stand-up period.
Exactly. The shocking death of his friend John Belushi from an overdose in 1982. Williams had actually partied with Belushi the night before he died, combined with the birth of his first son, Zach, served as this profound wake-up call.
That must have hit him incredibly hard.
Oh, yeah. He said it was a wake-up call on a huge level. He also mentioned the grand jury investigation into Belushi's death helped, too. This pivotal moment prompted him to quit drugs and alcohol cold turkey.
And that's when cycling came in.
That seems to be when it became really important. He explicitly told a bike shop owner once that cycling saved my life, using that intense physical exercise as a healthy substitute.
But he did relapse later, didn't he, with alcohol?
Sadly, yes. He relapsed in 2003, started drinking again while he was filming The Big White up in Alaska. He checked himself into rehab for alcoholism in 2006.
Okay, but not cocaine again.
No, apparently he never returned to cocaine. He famously declared in a 2010 interview, "Cocaine paranoid and impotent, what fun. No bit of me thinking, ooh, let's go back to that." It shows a very clear distinction in his mind about the dangers of different substances for him.
Right. Still a battle, though.
An ongoing battle. In mid-2014, not long before his death, he was admitted to the Hazelden Foundation Addiction Treatment Center, reportedly for alcoholism treatment, or perhaps just to fine-tune his sobriety, as some reports said. It illustrates his ongoing commitment to managing it, even in his final years.
Yeah. This comprehensive view, it just underscores the profound complexities of his life, doesn't it? A man of such immense light who was clearly, constantly battling these significant internal shadows.
Perfectly put. Mm. Immense light, significant shadows.
The story of Robin Williams, then, takes such a heartbreaking turn as we delve into the health battles he fought, largely in private, often it seems unbeknownst even to those closest to him, certainly to the public. What were the initial signs that things were seriously wrong, beyond his long-standing known struggles with depression and addiction?
You're right. It's a critical and just deeply sad part of his story. There were physical signs earlier on. Back in March 2009, he was hospitalized because of heart problems. It actually forced him to postpone a comedy tour he was on so he could have surgery.
Heart surgery, that's serious.
Very serious. He underwent an aortic valve replacement, a mitral valve repair, and a correction for an irregular heartbeat, all done at the Cleveland Clinic. That's a major set of procedures indicating significant physical strain already happening.
Wow, okay. And then closer to the end.
In the period leading up to his death in August 2014, his publicist, Mara Buxbaum, stated that he had been suffering from severe depression. Which, you know, people knew he struggled with depression on and off, but this was described as severe.
Right.
But then, his wife, Susan Schneider, later revealed something else. She revealed that he had also recently been diagnosed with early-stage Parkinson's disease. And it was a diagnosis he was not yet ready to share publicly.
Parkinson's, wow. That must have been absolutely devastating for someone so physical, so expressive.
Devastating. And this layer of private suffering, the Parkinson's diagnosis on top of the severe depression, was something few people, if any, outside his immediate circle could have anticipated, especially given his public image of just relentless joy and energy.
Yeah, it really changes the picture. But I understand his autopsy later revealed a different, maybe even more complex condition than Parkinson's. Can you clarify that for us? Because there was some confusion initially.
Yes, this is where the story takes a really crucial and tragic turn. And it's important because his death brought significant, much-needed awareness to a complex neurological condition that had often been overshadowed by other forms of dementia.
Like Alzheimer's.
Okay, so what did the autopsy find?
The autopsy found diffuse Lewy body disease. This clarified that a previous diagnosis of Parkinson's was, while understandable given the overlapping symptoms, ultimately a misdiagnosis, or at least an incomplete picture.
Diffuse Lewy body disease. What does that mean exactly? How is it different from Parkinson's?
Medical experts later stated that his symptoms were entirely consistent with dementia with Lewy bodies, or DLB. Lewy bodies are abnormal protein deposits in the brain. In early Parkinson's disease, these Lewy bodies are typically limited to certain areas of the brain, primarily affecting motor control.
But in dementia, with Lewy bodies, DLB, and especially diffuse Lewy body disease, these deposits are much more widespread throughout the brain. This affects not just movement, but also thinking, memory, sleep, behavior, and can cause significant psychiatric symptoms like hallucinations, paranoia, and severe fluctuations in attention and alertness. This widespread distribution was sadly the case with Williams.
So it was much more pervasive than just Parkinson's.
Much more pervasive and aggressive, yes. It helps explain the rapid decline and the profound suffering he experienced in his final months.
His wife, Susan Schneider, wrote about this very movingly, didn't she?
She did. In a poignant and incredibly informative essay published in the medical journal Neurology in 2016 titled "The Terrorist Inside My Husband's Brain," she described Williams' Lewy body dementia pathology as being among the worst the pathologists had seen.
Among the worst. That's chilling.
It is. She detailed the insidious early symptoms, which really started escalating around October 2013, about 10 months before his death. She described a sudden and prolonged spike in fear, anxiety, stress, severe insomnia, memory loss, profound paranoia, and terrifying delusions. Things that weren't typical for him, even with his history of depression.
He must have been terrified himself.
Heartbreakingly so. Schneider shared a quote from Williams during this time. Robin was losing his mind and he was aware of it. He kept saying, "I just want to reboot my brain."
Oh, wow. That's devastating to be aware you're losing control.
Unimaginable. Schneider also powerfully articulated the impact of the disease on his mental state, stating that his intense depression wasn't just psychological. It was a symptom of the LBD itself. It's not about psychology. It's rooted in neurology. His brain was falling apart.
Right. The disease was causing the depression, anxiety, paranoia.
Exactly. She called LBD the terrorist inside my husband's brain, a phrase that really encapsulates the unseen, relentless battle he was fighting against his own mind. This tragic revelation really challenges us to reconsider the why behind severe mental health struggles sometimes, and reminds us that outward joy can tragically mask these profound internal battles rooted in underlying devastating physical conditions.
That's such a powerful and deeply sad insight. It really recontextualizes so much of his behavior and suffering in those final years. So on August 11, 2014, the world lost Robin Williams. How did the world react?
Robin Williams died on August 11, 2014, at his home in Paradise Cay, California. He was 63 years old. the primary cause of death was determined to be suicide by hanging. A decision made, as we now understand, amidst the devastating impact of Lewy body dementia and the constellation of symptoms it caused.
Such a tragic end.
Incredibly tragic. His body was cremated, and his ashes were scattered over San Francisco Bay later that month on August 21st. The outpouring of tributes, as you can imagine, was just immediate, widespread, and deeply, deeply emotional. It was a testament to his truly universal impact.
I remember it felt like the whole world stopped for a moment.
It really did. President Barack Obama released a statement that captured his multifaceted career perfectly. He arrived in our lives as an alien, but he ended up touching every element of the human spirit. Just beautiful.
That's perfect. What about comedy world?
His peers were heartbroken. The Monty Python troupe dedicated their final reunion show performance to him. He had actually been scheduled to make a guest appearance, but had canceled due to his severe depression at the time. A really poignant gesture from his comedic idols.
Wow, even the UN commented.
Yes, the United Nations Assistant Secretary General quoted that profound line from Dead Poets Society, "Dare to look at things in a different way," showing his impact reached far beyond entertainment.
And Disney, given the genie?
Disney responded significantly. Disney Channel, Disney XD, and Disney Junior all aired Aladdin commercial-free, dedicating the broadcast to him with a special genie tribute image at the end. The cast of the Broadway musical Aladdin performed a very moving rendition of Friend Like Me in his honor on stage.
That must have been emotional.
Extremely. And Broadway itself dimmed its marquee lights on August 14th across New York City in his memory.
And the fans. I remember seeing pictures of memorials popping up everywhere.
Spontaneously, yes. Fans created these impromptu memorials at his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame at the iconic Goodwill Hunting Bench in Boston Public Garden.
The bench in Boston, yeah.
Outside the Mrs. Doubtfire House in San Francisco, even near the Jumanji board prop sign in Keene, New Hampshire, and the Mork and Mindy House in Boulder, Colorado. People just felt this need to connect and grieve publicly.
It showed how much he meant to people personally. What about major events like the Emmys?
At the 66th Primetime Emmy Awards, shortly after his death, his close friend Billy Crystal delivered this incredibly emotional, heartfelt tribute that just moved many, many people to tears. It was followed by classic clips of Williams' comedy, reminding everyone of the immense joy he brought amidst the sadness.
Billy Crystal must have been devastated.
Clearly. All the late-night talk show hosts, Letterman, Conan O'Brien, Seth Meyers, Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Fallon, they all paid their respects in deeply personal and often funny, often tearful ways. PBS aired a one-hour special on his career. Even the band Iron Maiden, surprisingly, dedicated a song called Tears of a Clown to him, exploring that theme of hidden depression behind comedic personas.
Iron Maiden, wow. His reach was incredible.
Truly incredible. And his legacy was further cemented with lasting physical memorials. The tunnel on Highway 101 just north of the Golden Gate Bridge was officially renamed the Robin Williams Tunnel in 2016.
The Rainbow Tunnel, that's perfect.
Isn't it? Yeah. And a meadow in Golden Gate Park, where he often performed early in his career, was renamed Robin Williams Meadow in 2017.
Lovely tributes. And there have been documentaries since.
Yes, several important ones. Robin Williams, Come Inside My Mind, produced by HBO in 2018, offered a really intimate look at his life and genius. David Iskoff's comprehensive biography, Robin, also came out in 2018. And significantly, the documentary Robin's Wish came out in 2020, which specifically focused on his battle with Lewy body dementia, featuring Susan Schneider and medical experts. It really aimed to bring understanding to what he went through.
Robin's Wish. That sounds essential for understanding the end of his life.
Very much so. And just recently, in 2022, he was posthumously inducted into the National Comedy Center's Hall of Fame. His passing, while utterly tragic, really served as this powerful, albeit painful, catalyst for increased awareness and understanding of a devastating, often misunderstood disease, shining a crucial light on the unseen battles that many people face.
Even through the sadness of his passing and all the revelations about his private struggles, Robin Williams' light, as you say, shines incredibly bright. His legacy continues to shape the world of entertainment and probably beyond. He was truly considered a national treasure, wasn't he? What specific impact did he have on comedy and acting as a whole? How did he change things?
He fundamentally shifted the landscape, no question. Judd Apatow famously said, "He raised the bar for what it's possible to do and made an enormous amount of us want to be comedians." But then he added, crucially, It's not possible to be a Robin Williams ripoff.
That says it all, doesn't it? You couldn't copy him.
Exactly. It speaks to his unparalleled originality and the sheer impossibility of replicating that unique blend of manic genius, vulnerability, and intellect. His onstage energy and his just astonishing improvisational skill became a model, or maybe an aspiration, for a whole new generation of stand-up comedians. He inspired them to push boundaries and embrace spontaneity in a way few had before.
And the honesty you mentioned earlier, that resonated too.
Oh, deeply. He was really valued for his openness, especially later in his career, about his struggles with drug and alcohol addiction and with depression. He managed to weave these deeply personal, often painful issues into his comedy in a way that was both hilarious and profoundly human.
Making it okay to talk about that stuff.
Exactly. Media scholar Derek A. Burrell actually argued that probably the most important contribution he made to pop culture was as Robin Williams the person, precisely because of this profound openness about his own life and struggles. It made him relatable despite his huge fame.
That's a fascinating point. And his performances influenced other actors too.
Immensely. Chris Columbus, who directed him in Mrs. Doubtfire, recalled watching him work as a magical and special privilege. His performances were unlike anything any of us had ever seen. They came from some spiritual and otherworldly place. That captures the almost mystical quality people felt about his talent.
A spiritual place.
Yeah. And Alyssa Rosenberg at the Washington Post, after reviewing his filmography following his death, noted how struck by the breadth and the radical diversity of his role she was. She concluded that Williams helped us grow up through the complex human stories he brought to life, both comedic and dramatic.
Helped us grow up. I like that. It wasn't just about laughs. It was about reflection, too, like you said.
Absolutely. And of course, beyond the critical acclaim and influence, he has the tangible symbols, the star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, his handprints and footprints at Grauman's Chinese Theater, cementing his enduring impact on Hollywood history.
Okay, let's talk a bit more about that style. That manic, quick-fire comedic style he was so famous for. How did that develop? Was it always there, or did it evolve? And what were his biggest influences? Who did he look up to?
His comedic style was truly a high-wire act, wasn't it? Just this rapid-fire assault of wit, characters, impressions, social commentary all at once. Williams himself acknowledged that the intense stress of performing stand-up, especially early on, the constant demand for new material, the lifestyle definitely contributed to his early drug and alcohol use.
As a way to cope with the pressure.
Seems like it.
Mm-hmm.
Though he clarified he never used substances on stage. He said he sometimes performed hungover, but cocaine, specifically, made him paranoid while performing, which actually stripped away the joy and spontaneity.
Interesting. So it didn't fuel the creativity in the way people might think.
Apparently not, according to him. He describes stand-up itself as a brutal field, warning about the dangers of burnout, bitterness, or just snapping under the pressure because it's so unforgiving.
Yeah, you hear that from a lot of comedians.
Biographer Emily Herbert characterized Williams' style aptly as intense, utterly manic, beyond energetic, beyond phonetic, sometimes dangerous because of what it said about the creator's own mental state. There was always that edge.
Where did that speed come from?
He explained that his quickfire delivery was actually developed in bars early in his career, where audiences wouldn't give him much time. They'd heckle or just tune out quickly. So his style became, as he put it, very much synaptic, quick firing, moving, so that they never really had a chance to lock on as a target. It was a defense mechanism that became his signature.
Wow. Born out of necessity.
Seems so. He famously used free association to keep the audience engaged and maybe himself stimulated. He never worried about running out of ideas, saying that constant changes in world events provided an endless supply of material.
He was always riffing on the news.
Always. But the competitive nature of comedy, unfortunately, did lead to some accusations of joke stealing over the years, which Williams strongly denied.
Yeah, that seems to plague comedy sometimes.
It does. He later made a point of deliberately avoiding attending other comedians' performances, partly to prevent any subconscious borrowing or further claims. Whoopi Goldberg defended him on this, saying it happens all the time in the somewhat insular comedy world, not always intentionally.
Right. It's a tricky area. Did he ever worry about losing that creative spark?
Oh, profoundly. Mm-hmm. In a really revealing Playboy interview back in 1992, he expressed this deep fear of losing his creativity, of becoming, in his words, dull but a rock, unable to speak, fire off, or talk about things. That rapid-fire ability was clearly central to his identity.
He feared becoming boring.
Exactly. But interestingly, he credited his father with strengthening his self-confidence, encouraging him never to be afraid to talk about important subjects. And that, perhaps, empowered his later honesty on stage, tackling difficult topics.
It's fascinating how those early family dynamics, like trying to make his mom laugh or getting confidence from his dad, continued to shape his professional courage throughout his life.
It really seems they did. Deep roots.
So who were the comedic giants he looked up to? Who helped forge that unique, incredible style?
His comedic style was definitely influenced by an impressive roster of legends. It was a real blend of anarchic genius and incisive wit. Jonathan Winters was his absolute idol. He saw him perform on TV at age 8 and was just blown away.
Jonathan Winters, another master improviser.
Exactly. Williams said Winters inspired him with the idea that anything is possible, that anything is funny. Freeform. That seems like a foundational principle for his own improvisational brilliance.
You can see the connection there. Who else?
Peter Sellers. Especially Sellers' amazing multi-character roles in Dr. Strangelove. That was a huge influence, showing Williams the power of physical transformation and deep character work within comedy.
Ah, Sellers. Makes sense. Any British influence?
Yes, he admired British comedians like Dudley Moore and Peter Cook, known for their intellectual and often subversive humor.
Beyond the Fringe, Pete and Dud.
Yeah, and Richard Pryor. Pryor's fearless ability to talk about his personal life, including his own struggles with drugs and alcohol right there on stage, that profoundly affected Williams.
Pryor really broke down barriers with that.
He absolutely did. Williams adopted this radical honesty, famously calling it cheaper than therapy, and a way to release pent-up energy, making his own struggles relatable, sometimes even humorous, to the audience.
Who else did he admire?
He admired the legendary duo Nichols and May for their intellectual wit and their dynamic improvisation. He liked Jay Leno for his quickness and his ability to connect with an audience, and Sid Caesar for his precious acts, those incredible character sketches. It shows a deep appreciation for the craft of comedy across its many forms and styles.
That's a heck of a list of influences. Winters, Sellers, Pryor, Nichols, and May. Wow.
He learned from the greats. And his own incredible career, of course, garnered him numerous major awards, solidifying his place in entertainment history across multiple disciplines.
Let's just recap those main awards because it's quite a haul.
It really is. He won the Academy Award, of course, for Best Supporting Actor for Good Will Hunting, a powerful testament to his dramatic range.
Great Oscar, yeah.
He received 6 Golden Globe Awards over his career, including Best Actor Awards for Good Morning, Vietnam, The Fisher King, and Mrs. Doubtfire. Plus that special Golden Globe for vocal work in Aladdin we talked about.
6 Golden Globes.
And he was honored by the Golden Globes with their prestigious Cecil B. DeMille Award in 2005, recognizing his outstanding contributions to the world of entertainment overall.
The Lifetime Achievement Award.
Nice. Beyond film, he collected 2 Primetime Emmy Awards for his television work and stand-up specials, 2 Screen Actors Guild Awards from his peers, and 5 Grammy Awards for his comedy albums.
Oscar, Emmys, Golden Globes, SAG Awards, Grammys. He really conquered every major award show.
Just about. It showcases a truly unparalleled career breadth. His impact, both through the immense laughter he generated and through the profound vulnerability he eventually shared, remains just immeasurable. He left an indelible mark on generations.
What an incredible journey we've taken today, really diving deep into the life of Robin Williams. We've explored his surprisingly shy beginnings back in Chicago, witnessed his meteoric rise from the San Francisco comedy clubs to become this global film star.
Yeah, that arc is amazing in itself.
We celebrated his unparalleled versatility across both comedy and drama and marveled at his profound generosity through his extensive philanthropy, like Comic Relief.
A huge heart.
But we've also, you know, gently navigated the difficult terrain of his private struggles from addiction and depression, which he was open about, to the devastating neurological disease, Lewy body dementia, that ultimately claimed him, which he fought in private.
Mm-hmm. A battle many didn't see.
Our sources, primarily that detailed Wikipedia entry and the insights shared by those close to him, they've allowed us to kind of stitch together a portrait of a man who was both immensely human and at the same time utterly extraordinary. Just a complex tapestry of brilliance and vulnerability.
That's a perfect description.
So thank you, everyone, for joining us on this deeply personal deep dive today.
You know, Robin Williams' life, it really powerfully illustrates that deep interplay between incredible creativity, profound vulnerability, and sheer resilience. His legacy isn't just in the laughter or even the tears he provoked in his dramatic role.
Right, it's more than that.
It's powerfully in the honesty he eventually shared, even if much of it came posthumously, about his battles. And that encourages, I think, a deeper empathy and understanding for the complex inner lives of those people we admire, those people who make us laugh.
Yeah, that's so important.
So as we reflect on Robin Williams' extraordinary life and his undeniable impact, maybe consider this. How many other brilliant minds, other creative spirits, might be navigating similar unseen battles right now? What can we, all of us, learn from his story to maybe foster a more compassionate and understanding world? A world where the struggles behind the smiles are not only acknowledged, but are actually met with empathy and support.
That's a powerful thought to carry with us. Thank you for that. And thank you all for listening. Join us next time for another deep dive into the stories that shape our world.